Welcome to The Lead. I'm Jake Tapper, and we begin today with the national lead, a humanitarian crisis in this country, growing more severe by the minute as thousands of migrant children without parents or guardians are overwhelming facilities at the U.S.-Mexico border. As a new administration struggles to explain how it is going to better handle this influx humanely while also discouraging future migrants. These photos, released today by Democratic Congressman Henry Cuellar's office, show conditions inside one of those border control facilities in Donna, Texas, over the weekend, showing what appear to be mostly teenagers crammed together, wrapped in Mylar blankets. Not all that different from heartbreaking images we saw during the Trump years, or for that matter, during a similar crisis when Barack Obama was president in 2014. Today, we saw this rare look inside these facilities. Since the Biden administration has not granted news media access to the facility, citing COVID restrictions, despite the president's promise in his inaugural address to always level with you. Blocking access to the news media is not leveling with the American people, Mr. President. Now, politicians and some in the news media often frame this problem superficially, but the reasons for this influx of migrants, well, they're complicated. Some of the exodus from Central America is because of poverty and crime and natural disasters there. And would have happened whomever was president. After all, there was a similar spike in 2019 under President Trump, despite his draconian policies. And the numbers of arrests at the border began rising in 2020 after that precipitous decline due to the pandemic prompting border closures. But it is also true, experts say, that some of this crisis is because President Biden has reversed Trump-era policies, which had previously kept migrants out and stranded in Mexico, creating the bottleneck that the system is now dealing with. Now, bear in mind, that approach did not stop the crisis of unaccompanied minors. It just made it someone else's problem. Now, some migrants are saying they're coming specifically because Biden's policies are more humane or less harsh. Children, for example, are not being snatched from their parents and separated as a matter of policy, as happened under Trump. Either way, the challenge for the Biden administration, which vowed to treat these migrants humanely, is that the resources still do not appear to be there to back up that promise, at least right now, as CNN's Caitlin Collins reports.
The Biden administration is now scrambling to control the biggest border surge in two decades.
It is taking time and it is difficult because the entire system was dismantled by the prior administration.
President Biden's Homeland Security Secretary defending their response as Biden says he's aware of the conditions inside crowded Border Patrol facilities.
I know what's going on with those facilities.
The president has no trips to the border planned, but sent a top immigration official to meet with Mexican leaders today about stemming the surge of migrants.
What we are conveying from our end is that the border is not open.
For weeks, the White House has declined to call it a crisis, but now officials are explicitly saying it isn't one.
Children presenting at our border who are fleeing violence, who are fleeing prosecution, who are fleeing terrible situations is not a crisis.
Almost 4,900 unaccompanied migrant children are now being held in Border Patrol facilities, with over 800 there for more than 10 days, far longer than the 72 hours the law allows. Secretary Mayorkas visited the border this weekend, but didn't take reporters with him as the administration continues to deny access to the facilities.
We're working on independent press coverage. I certainly hope to have an update for you very soon, but I can't give you a deadline on that.
Instead, reporters have been forced to rely on lawmakers. Democratic Congressman Henry Cuellar released these pictures showing unaccompanied migrant children sleeping on floors in a crowded Border Patrol facility in Texas. The backlash has been bipartisan. Democratic Arizona Senator Kyrsten Sinema and GOP Texas Senator John Cornyn both urged Biden today to use his full authorities to effectively respond and said current facilities are insufficient. And President Trump, who separated migrant children from their parents while he was in office, also criticized Biden's policies today.
People are just pouring into our country and they will destroy our country.
And Jake, just to give you a sense of how much the administration is being pressed on this, the vice president is in Florida right now to talk about vaccines and the ongoing pandemic. But she was asked by reporters about whether she plans to visit the border. She said not right now, but she believes she will in the future. And again, said this is a, quote, challenging situation that was left to them by the previous administration.
All right, Caitlin Collins at the White House, thanks so much. CNN's Rosa Flores is live for us outside the Border Patrol facility in Donna, Texas. And Rosa, you're hearing from someone who was inside this facility?
I've talked to a woman who says that she was processed inside the facility and then she was dropped off by Border Patrol at a nearby bus station. Here's how she described it. Take a listen.
So how many people were in there?
250 personas.
Como 250, 250, en el lugar de donde usted estaba. ¿Y era un cuarto grande o cómo era? So in a big, large room, she says that there was about 200, 250 people. The men are separated from the women. She was in the area where women were with children.
Now, CNN's repeated requests to gain access to the facility that you see behind me have been denied. Information instead that we're getting here is being filtered by tweets, press releases, and now photographs released by U.S. Congressman Henry Cuellar showing some of those overcrowded conditions. But let me tell you something. This is not the first time that we hear about these overcrowded conditions. More than a week ago, attorneys representing children inside the facility that you see behind me blew the whistle, telling CNN that the capacity of the facility is about 1,000 and that at the time it was housing about 2,000. Now take a look behind me. The facility is being expanded. There's a full-fledged expansion. We've asked Customs and Border Protection about this. We have not heard back, but here's what we do know. About 4,900 children are in Customs and Border Protection custody, more than 800 of those for more than 10 days. That is way above the 72-hour legal limit, and another 10,500 are in HHS custody. So, Jake, regardless of what the administration wants to call it, whether a crisis or a challenge, what we're seeing here on the ground, we'd like to see some transparency, access for media so that we could get an objective eye inside these facilities. Jake?
All right, Rosa Flores, live outside a border facility in Texas. Thanks so much. Joining us now to discuss, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki. Jen, thanks for joining us today. Democratic Congressman Henry Cuellar released these images, I'm sure you've seen, of a migrant overflow facility in Donna, Texas over the weekend. Does the president believe that these conditions are acceptable?
No, he doesn't. And that's why he wants to move children as quickly as possible out of the Border Patrol facilities. They're not meant for children. And that's why he wants to open more shelters. He wants to increase and expedite processing at the border. And this is an issue he's focused on every single day, Jake.
I know the administration is trying to speed up processing at the border, as you just noted. But of course, that takes time. That takes resources. Right now, documents from your own Customs and Border Protection show that some children have been in custody for more than 10 days. The law obviously says 72 hours is the limit, as you just heard from Rosa. So what are you doing right now to fix this? Is President Biden perhaps going to ask Congress for emergency funding to help alleviate the conditions there?
Well, Jake, I've asked our experts about this. It's less an issue of funding. It's more an issue of needing more facilities and needing to expedite the processing. So you've seen we've announced the opening of new facilities. We'll announce the opening of more in the coming days and weeks, places where kids can have access to health care, can have access to educational resources, even legal resources. That's one step, but also expediting processing at the border. A lot of these kids, some of these kids, I should say, have phone numbers in their pockets. The president wants them to be able to, those phone calls to be able to be made to expedite that quickly so that we can get them to safe homes. Those are two of the steps we're taking. A third one, let me just note, is that we're restarting the program that allows Central American Minors Program that allows kids to apply while they're still in country so they don't make the journey at all. That was something that was ended under President Trump, and we are restarting that program.
After Homeland Security Secretary Mayorkas repeated yesterday that the southern border is closed, the Wall Street Journal editorial board, obviously a very conservative board, but they wrote this piece titled The U.S.-Made Border Crisis, and they write, quote, Mr. Mayorkas is finally trying to send a message that migrants should not flood the border, but the Biden administration isn't changing the policy incentives that encourage them to arrive. It has exempted children who set foot in the U.S., so parents send their children to enter, and they then stay with relatives, unquote. Now, look, it's obviously a complicated issue. We saw spikes during the Trump years as well, 2019 especially. Mm-hmm. This latest influx began under the previous administration. And obviously there's crime and there's poverty and there are natural disasters causing this influx. But in addition to that, there is this change of policy, this more humane way to treat these migrants. Do you accept the degree to which that change? I mean, you're balancing two competing priorities here. You want to be humane. You don't want to be ripping kids mm-hmm. from their parents. But at the same time, that humanity might serve as a beckoning for some of these migrants. Do you accept that?
Look, Jake, I think there's a lot of factors. And sure, this president, I think, is perceived as more humane. We'll take that. But I also think, you noted a lot of these, there were two hurricanes. People are fleeing really challenging economic conditions, crime, poverty. Smugglers are encouraging kids and families to take these journeys. We know we're working against a lot of headwinds here, and there's more work we have to do to keep reiterating this is not the time to come, this is not a safe journey to make, and that people are being turned away at the border. And we're doing a lot in countries through our embassies to win radio ads and Facebook ads and social media to convey that message. And there's also a trip that is happening right now with some of our senior officials to some of these countries to have discussions as well. So we're using a lot of levers, but we also understand there's a lot of headwinds that we're working against here.
And just quickly, I remember during the Obama years, then DHS Secretary Jay Johnson flying down to the Northern Triangle countries mm-hmm. saying, don't come, making a big high-profile announcement. Do not come. We're not going to let people in. Does Secretary Mayorkas plan on doing something like that?
I think there's no question we'll have senior officials down in the border, in these countries, as you conveyed, and high-level officials, I expect, down in these countries having negotiations and discussions. We need to have a diplomatic partnership to address these issues. We also need funding to address the root causes. That's something historically, Jake, as you know, that Democrats and Republicans, Senator Lindsey Graham even, have worked with then-Vice President Biden on to get funding. We proposed that in the immigration bill, and we're hopeful that we can move forward on getting some funding to address the root causes as well.
Jen, President Biden, Vice President Harris, and other high-profile surrogates are traveling again this week to promote the coronavirus relief law, mm-hmm. which included $1,400 checks for low- and middle-income Americans. We know some progressive Democrats have pushed for recurring payments, not just a one-time payment of $1,400, but more. And there is this idea of a fourth round of stimulus checks making headlines in local and some national outlets. Is the White House considering something like that, a fourth stimulus?
Well, we're obviously going to look at the economic data and what the needs are. And what the president's focused on now is figuring out what's next as a part of his Build Back Better agenda. It's no secret that's going to be about jobs. He's having policy discussions through the course of the next several days and weeks. And I expect he'll have more to convey on what's next soon.
This afternoon, Vice President Harris visited a vaccination center in Jacksonville. And today we learned that AstraZeneca plans to apply for emergency use authorization for its vaccine next month. Infectious disease expert Dr. Celine Gounder says by the time the AstraZeneca vaccine is available in the U.S., there will already be enough supply to vaccinate every American already, so that Biden administration should donate its entire AstraZeneca supply to help with the worldwide effort. Are you talking about that at all? Do you agree with that analysis?
Well, as you noted, it hasn't been approved by the FDA yet, or you alluded to, I should say. And there's a lot of factors we're accounting for here, Jake. One, we don't know which vaccine is most effective with kids. We obviously have variants that are developing, and we want to make sure we have a range of options, a lot of flexibility to ensure we have the right vaccines available. So there's a lot of factors our medical experts are considering. We did announce that we're going to be lending about 4 million doses total to Canada and Mexico, our neighbor countries, and we want to be a part of the global effort to address the pandemic. So there's no question these conversations will continue. And as we're more confident in our supply and what the needs are that we have to address, we will certainly be contributing more or lending more to other countries.
The Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin made a trip to Afghanistan over the weekend. Former President Trump made a deal to have all American troops withdrawn from Afghanistan by May 1st. President Biden has not committed to that deadline. And obviously, there is not a firm peace deal with the Taliban. Will he confirm go along with that deadline of May 1st, or are you kicking that can until the Biden administration figures out what it wants to do in Afghanistan?
Well, we're not kicking any can, but I'm going to leave the president the space to make a decision about what's next. He's currently having meetings with his policy teams and experts on this. As you noted, his Secretary of Defense was in Afghanistan, and those discussions are ongoing. So nothing to preview for you today.
And last question, I just want to circle back on the migrant question, which is, if you're sending the signal that kids who come to the United States and have the phone numbers of relatives in their pocket, that you want to get them to those houses, Isn't that message, which you just made a few minutes ago, going to encourage more of this? And look, we all want to be humane, but one of the big fears here and risks here is the journey and in which kids, especially girls, but all sorts of children and families are preyed upon by coyotes and other criminals. Are you not afraid that when you say that, and I understand the motivation, you want to get these kids into a safe place once they're here, but even just saying that might get some more kids on the road in dangerous situations, no?
Well, Jake, that's certainly not our objective. I appreciate you raising it. I think what I was trying to answer is what we're trying to do to prevent so many kids from being in the Border Patrol facilities, which I think we all agree is not a place for kids and not one that just should be for longer than 3 days at max. But our message we're sending clearly, and I mentioned we're doing it through a lot of mediums, through social media, through radio, through TV. We're trying to meet people where they are in the region, is that this is not a safe journey, as you mentioned, that this is not the time to come, and that people will be turned away at the border. And that those statistics certainly bear that out. But that is the message overwhelmingly we're sending. But we also want to be clear that we're going to do everything we can to ensure that kids are not left in these facilities for longer than they should be.
All right. It's a complicated issue, no doubt. Jen Psaki, the White House press secretary, thanks so much for being
on the
show. Appreciate it. The Biden administration has its take on the AstraZeneca vaccine. Up next, the medical opinion on this brand. Plus, Donald Trump, his rewards for loyalty, and a notable absence on his new list of Republicans to be on the lookout for. Stay with us. In our Healthy Today, positive data out today in the U.S. trial of the AstraZeneca vaccine. It is 79% effective against symptomatic COVID and 100% effective against severe disease and hospitalization. But even though we know outside is safer than inside, officials are still concerned over scenes such as this one from Miami Beach, with swaths of rowdy spring breakers not wearing masks or social distancing. Today, the CDC director warned that the nation could be headed for yet another avoidable surge, as CNN's Nick Watnow reports.
Despite the virus and the variants, despite a curfew and police pepper balls, you're watching Miami Beach this weekend. Spring breakers.
It feels in some ways like our city is a Tinder right now. You know, we're one of the few destinations open, and so people are flocking here.
We are a critical point in this pandemic, a fork in the road.
8% of new cases in Florida, we're told, are that more contagious variant first found in the UK. In New Jersey, it's 9%.
The Northeast and the Upper Midwest are beginning to again see a significant rise in cases.
A little bit reminiscent of what happened last spring.
But there is some optimism that despite what we're seeing in Florida, vaccines will win the race against the variants.
We're talking about some form of protective immunity in about 55% of the population. So there's enough of a backstop here that I don't think you're going to see a fourth surge.
He's talking about the 80 million plus Americans who've likely already been infected and the 80 million plus who've had at least one vaccine dose. Three vaccines rolling out already, and AstraZeneca just published some late-stage U.S. trial results.
Good results. 78.9% vaccine efficacy at preventing symptomatic disease.
100% against severe disease, and zero evidence it causes blood clots.
The AstraZeneca vaccine is seen as the world's vaccine. It's inexpensive, it's easy to store and to transport.
But will those apparently baseless fears in Europe over clotting still put people off? In this pandemic, misinformation and messaging matter. They are life or death, says the man once tasked by Trump to lead the quest for a vaccine.
Many people probably have died or suffered because the whole situation became so political.
Now, as of 8 a.m. Wednesday morning, Arizona is going to open vaccine eligibility to anyone and everyone 16 and older. One of only three states so far to go that low. The others are Alaska and Mississippi. And don't forget that the Biden administration sticking to that pledge that within the next 6 weeks, every adult in America will be eligible for a vaccine. Jake.
All right. The real challenge, of course, eligibility, but also getting those shots into arms. Nick Watt, thanks so much. CNN's chief medical correspondent, Dr. Sanjay Gupta, joins us now. Sanjay, what does this AstraZeneca data mean for the United States? When do you think we should be able to expect that everybody who wants a shot, who's an adult, can get a shot?
Yeah, well, I think the data looks good, Jake. We've been through this a few times now, obviously, with other drug manufacturers and see what the FDA is looking for. So you showed, I mean, the data, 79% effective against disease overall, but 100% effective in terms of preventing hospitalizations and deaths. I mean, that's obviously very significant. No significant safety concerns were relayed as part of this data as well. So what happens? We know that AstraZeneca is going to apply for an emergency use authorization. They say they'll do it in the first half of April. When we went back and looked at the other process for the other drug companies, it took about 3 weeks after that, Jake. So talking maybe first week of May or so before this vaccine would be available. 30 million doses. They say they've already manufactured another 20 million doses by the end of May. So it's significant. I think that the idea that by, you know, middle end of May, you're going to have clearly enough vaccine out there that the supply will be outstripping the demand.
Sanjay, in light of the recent controversies with the AstraZeneca vaccine in Europe, how can the FDA shore up confidence in AstraZeneca with Americans? I mean, hesitancy is already a problem. 36% say they don't want to take the vaccine at all, according to a CNN poll.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think it would be naive to say that that's not going to have an impact. I don't think it should, because this is one of those situations where, you know, everyone's antenna is sort of raised and any potential side effects, and, you know, you find things that end up not being, you know, being caused by the vaccine. And that's what they've established in Europe via the World Health Organization, via the European Medicine Association. So the clotting issue really is not an issue with regard to this vaccine. Having said that, you know, people are already hesitant. They got other choices of vaccines out there. So they may say, hey, look, I think you're right, but I'm just going to pass on this particular vaccine, maybe take another vaccine. Or there's a lot of people who are sort of starting to fade away from the idea of needing to take a vaccine. They think, I'm not hesitant, just like all the numbers look like they're improving, so why do I need to bother? That shouldn't happen, because in order for us to be best positioned coming out of summer, we need to have as many people vaccinated as possible.
You have CDC Director Rochelle Walensky saying that she's worried we're going to have another avoidable surge, but then you might change the channel and you hear former FDA Commissioner Dr. Scott Gottlieb saying he does not think there's going to be a fourth wave because enough people have immunity, because so many have been vaccinated already. Where do you come down in this debate? Do you think we're headed for a fourth wave?
Well, you know, I hate to sort of be the arbiter of this sort of discussion. I talked to both these folks quite a bit, you know, off the record. But I think that I think it's unlikely, frankly, when you just look at the data, that we're going to have a significant fourth surge. Let me say a couple things. One is that, you know, obviously the numbers have plateaued, maybe even gone up a little bit in terms of case numbers. We know that. You do have increasing vaccination. You have warmer weather. And as Scott Gottlieb stated, there is a lot of existing immunity that already exists. Those are the pros. Cons, people sort of are still looking at this. Many people are looking at this in the rearview mirror. I mean, if we started to go into April or May in a better position, then I feel very confident saying we're not going to have a fourth surge. So the fact that people are not being as adherent is a concern. And then there's always these strains that are of concern. I think with the UK strain, I'm not as worried. That's a concerning strain. But these other strains, like the Brazil strain, if that starts to become a more common strain here, that would be a problem. But when I piece it all together, Jake, not to get out of your question, but I piece it all together, I don't think that there's going to be a significant surge of cases, even if there's upticks. And also, what do you mean by surge, right? Is it going to lead to a corresponding number of increase in hospitalizations and deaths? I don't think so, given the immunity. I hope I'm not wrong on this, but that's where the data sort of, that's what the data suggests.
And also all those people who are in the most vulnerable populations who have been disproportionately immunized, especially seniors. Dr. Sanjay Gupta, thanks so much. Appreciate it. A puzzling move by the Justice Department. Why a top prosecutor might have talked so openly about adding sedition charges against rioters at the U.S. Capitol and floated a possible investigation into Donald Trump. That's next. In our politics lead today, the January 6th Capitol insurrectionists could face sedition charges, according to the man who was in charge of the investigation. Michael Sherwin, the former acting D.C. U.S. attorney, also tells 60 Minutes that former President Donald Trump may be culpable for that insurrection.
We have soccer moms from Ohio that were arrested saying, well, I did this because my president said I had to take back our house. That moves the needle towards that direction. Maybe the president is culpable for those actions.
In short, you have investigators looking into the president's role.
We have people looking at everything. Correct.
Joining me now is CNN's Evan Perez. And Evan, you're learning there's been quite a bit of fallout over Sherwin's comments about all that.
Yeah, look, Jake, this is the new no-drama Justice Department after January 20th, certainly after the arrival of Merrick Garland, who's coming off 25 years serving on the federal bench. They don't believe that the officials here in this building, that is, do not believe that the prosecutor should be out there talking about an ongoing investigation. And in particular, it's the comments that Sherwin made about the sedition charges. He made clear that he believes the facts currently support bringing those charges. That is something, by the way, that we've previously reported. Prosecutors have recommended bringing those charges against some of the insurrectionists from January 6th. And that decision now is in the hands of the bosses upstairs from where I'm sitting. And so what could happen now is obviously this makes clear that if they go in a different direction, we'll know that there was a difference of opinion behind the scenes, something that you don't usually get here at this building.
And as of now, there's no indication that a formal criminal investigation has been opened against Donald Trump. So what does culpable, what does that really mean?
Well, look, I think culpable means that that is one of the factors that people upstairs are going to be weighing in deciding whether the president should be held criminally liable in this investigation. There is a lot of other evidence. If you hear some of his comments from Sherwin's interview with 60 Minutes, you know, he says also that, you know, obviously there's free speech elements to this. There are some people who showed up and said they did this on purpose because they knew Trump wasn't going to do anything. So I think his comments about culpability, I think, will be part of what the attorney general and other officials here will be trying to weigh as they make a decision whether the president should be facing charges. Again, at this point, Jake, we don't really see that as the likeliest outcome, but you never know what the facts will show at the end of this investigation.
Big difference between morally culpable and legally
culpable. Absolutely.
Evan Perez at the Department of Justice, thanks so much. The new political plans for former President Trump, including a return online that his supporters claim will redefine social media. That's next. Stay with us. And our politics lead, former President Trump, trying to play kingmaker, backing a challenger to run against incumbent Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger. You might remember Raffensperger. He refused to overturn his state's election results in November, even after Trump infamously phoned him and told him to find the needed number of votes to overturn the election results, a matter currently being investigated by Georgia prosecutors. On a podcast, Trump said that and listed the Republicans he thought would be the future of the GOP. All, of course, have a long history of being very loyal to him. Also notable, some whom he did not name. Let's discuss with our political panel. Melody, let me start with you. The man that Trump endorsed for Secretary of State, Congressman Jody Heiss, he's a fervent Trump loyalist. He spread the same election fraud lies that Trump pushed. He backed a lawsuit to overturn Biden's victory in battleground states. He objected to the certification of the Electoral College votes even after the insurrection. So this is something of a fringe member of Congress, and Trump wants him to be in charge of the elections in Georgia. What's your reaction?
Well, first of all, it's great to be with you, Jake. Secondly, I would say the rough and tumble of politics and picking and choosing who you would like to run and who you'll endorse is standard fare. But I think what's unusual here is that Trump has taken the enemy of my enemy is my friend attitude to a whole new level because he's going against people who wouldn't do him the favor of breaking the law for him. And what that leads to is the situation that we're in now, where he's endorsing people who he believes have been loyal to him, and doing that in a state where he's also encouraging the kind of voter suppression and changes in laws that will fundamentally undermine American democracy. And I think at base, that is the essential question here. You know, if we're just focusing on whether or not Donald Trump is seeking revenge, we're taking our eye off the ball, which is what's happening to American democracy.
And the president gave an interview on Lisa Booth's podcast, Lonnie, where he was asked about the future of the Republican Party, asked to name some future stars. He named Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, Missouri Senator Josh Hawley, Texas Senator Ted Cruz, Kentucky Senator Rand Paul, Arkansas gubernatorial candidate Sarah Huckabee Sanders, and South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem, loyalists one and all. Among those not mentioned, Vice President Pence, who I guess, Lonnie, he failed the loyalty test.
Yeah, I guess that's the case. Look, I've been involved, Jake, in three Republican presidential primary campaigns, and I can tell you the lanes in these primary campaigns, you know, they get pretty narrow. So the notion that you're playing only for Trump's vote or only for Trump's support, I think ends up being a fundamentally losing strategy in this. I mean, look, I think a lot of these guys are going to claim to be the heir apparent to Donald Trump. But at the end of the day, that's a risky proposition because you don't know where Donald Trump himself is going to land. You don't know who he's going to end up endorsing. You don't know if he's going to run himself. And so you have to really approach this very carefully if you're one of these folks that's thinking about running in 2024. How do you position yourself vis-a-vis the president? How do you garner support with the president's supporters while not hinging too much of your campaign on the president's support himself? Because that, by its very nature, I think is going to be quite capricious.
And Melody, in the same interview, Trump said he will decide sometime later if he's going to run for president again. What do Democrats need to do to prepare for a potential Trump presidential run, you think?
Well, a couple of things, Jake. One, if you're in Donald Trump's head, which is an interesting place to be, there are reasons to think about running. I mean, we had the highest voter turnout in 120 years, and he placed second only to the winner, President Biden. So, and he also managed to pick up among Asian Americans, among African American men in the Latino community. And I think while Democrats are also focused on governing right now and the control they have over the White House and over both branches of government, there are important and critical questions that they have to ask and answer as to why that happened, why Donald Trump was able to exploit something there in those communities and what the message was. And simultaneously, while you've got the reins of government, do things that help American people understand that you're working for them and, in fact, that government can work for them. And I think that's what the recovery, rescue plan was about. That's why they're talking about going big right now on a jobs and infrastructure bill.
And Lonnie, I never know how much to believe any Trump flack when they go on TV. But according to one of them, Trump's going to have his own platform on social media in the next 2 or 3 months. Maybe that's true. Maybe it's not. I don't know. What did you think when you heard that?
Yeah, I mean, look, Donald Trump's going to continue to try to figure out ways to influence the political dialogue, whether that's on his own social media network or via the good old-fashioned press release that goes out and is covered by mainstream media. He's going to try and figure out how he remains involved and engaged. So if he comes up with a new way to do it, you know, more power to him. I do know that not being on Twitter anymore has meant a lot more peace for people's lives and has also meant that, frankly, I think his reach has been a little bit more limited since he's no longer able to get the word out as quickly.
Oh, quite limited. Lonnie Chan and Melody Barnes, thanks to both of you. Good to see both of you. Coming up next, what it takes to reopen our schools. The COVID safety precautions in one great city could serve as a lesson for educators nationwide. Stay with us. In our national lead, the majority of high school students return to in-person learning in the nation's largest school district today, and half of them will be back in their New York City classrooms 5 days a week. It's not the same story in the great city of Philadelphia, where a hybrid learning plan has its pre-kindergarten through second graders in schools just 2 days a week, and the rest still learning just online, leaving some educators worried about setbacks for the students, as CNN's Bianca Goladriga reports.
I feel optimistic, guardedly, but I feel optimistic.
It's been nearly 2 weeks since students have returned to Philadelphia's Greenfield Elementary School, and already some familiar sounds.
Why don't you share what you got so far?
Really had no issues with kids following the safety protocols and safety guidelines. And at the same time, we're trying to make it fun for them.
Fun, but far from normal. Under Philadelphia's hybrid plan, pre-K through second grade students are back in school buildings 2 days a week.
We can lay out what our plan is to try and get all families who want to come back to come back. People are going to have to make their own decision of what they feel comfortable with.
The district has installed hand sanitizers, mandated masks, 6 feet of social distancing, even devoting an entire day to scrubbing down schools. Some medical experts don't think that's necessary.
What made you decide to impose one day where children are not in school dedicated to just cleaning?
That was done in part because of the recommendation, but also in part to develop and build that trust for individuals.
Superintendent William Height is especially concerned about the city's youngest students. Recent data shows an almost 15% decline in reading comprehension for first grade students.
The regression has occurred. It is real. And for young people, many young people who are already struggling, they have been disproportionately impacted.
An in-person option will be expanded for more students in the coming weeks.
What is your realistic goal in terms of what a classroom's going to look like by the end of this school year?
My realistic goal is to get as many children in as possible.
K through 12,
right. So, and if we get up to middle school, then that would be success for us. But if we get to 12th grade, that's even more success.
I feel like high school was our chance to still have our childhood and to be kids, and now we don't have that.
We met up with three high school students outside of their school, which remains closed.
I don't even know where, like, the school life and the just everyday home life just, like, it's just blurred, and I feel like I'm always in school.
It's hard because as the older kids in the household, we're also like in school and trying to help our siblings in school and trying to provide while our parents are at work.
The toll of remote learning is almost immeasurable.
My mental health hasn't been good.
I just got a therapist, you know.
And yet, despite all of their setbacks, they are nervous about returning to the classroom, whenever that may be.
It's hard not being like being able to see your friends. But at the same time, like, I definitely would not want to go back if it means endangering my friends.
Height is well aware of the sacrifices high school students are making.
I want them to understand that this is not going to be forever.
What is it going to feel like for you when you go back into that classroom with your peers for the first time again?
Oh my God, it would be like euphoric. Like, I don't even know how to like explain how much I miss my friends.
And Jake, it's not every day that we hear from older students, high school students in particular, as to how this year has impacted them, which is why it was so important for us to find those three young women. You can see what a toll this year has had on them, even though they're still alarmed and nervous about going back to school. Now, Superintendent Height said he hopes to have older students back by the end of this school year, and he's also going to be implementing summer school programs to get more of these students on board.
All right, Bianca Golodriga with the latest in our series, Education in a Time of COVID. Thank you so much. Coming up, here from a survivor of the Atlanta spa shootings as leaders push for new hate crime laws in the wake of the senseless tragedy. That's coming up. Before we go today, we want to take the time to remember just one of the 542,000 lives lost to COVID in the U.S. Today, we want to take the time to remember Bishop Omar Jawar. He was just 47 years old. People in Dallas knew him as Bishop Omar. He used his organization, Urban Specialists, to be a peacemaker between rival gang members. It was not unusual to see him in court testifying on behalf of people facing jail time. Bishop Omar was also a go-to for former felons getting out of prison, trying to get their life back on track. COVID consumed his last 6 months of life. He was diagnosed back in October. Lung infections kept him in the hospital. He died last Thursday. His family held a burial earlier today. His wife wants the world to remember his love, his spirit, and his integrity for all mankind. To the Jawar family, our condolences. May his memory be a blessing. Our coverage on CNN continues right now.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country. Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.